Jewish audio on Kabad.org.
Good evening, everyone. Today we'll be studying the Torah portion of Beshalach, and Beshalach contains the song that the Jewish people sang when they left Egypt at the splitting of the sea. And therefore the Shabbat is called Shabbat Shirah, the Shabbos of Song. And it begins chapter 13, verse number 17. And Vahi Bishalach Paro Sa'om, and Paro sends the people away. And in verse 20, it says Vahisa Masukos, and they journeyed from Sukkos. Now I'd like to bring out an interesting point. There is a major misconception that people have concerning the reason we eat matzahs on Pesach. If you ask a person, many people, even those that are more knowledgeable, will reply the reason that we eat matzahs on Pesach is because the Jews did not have enough time to bake the matzah before the to wait until after the bread would rise. They were forced to bake the matzah before the dough would rise, that is. And that's why we eat matzah. That's not true. And Rav Shneur Zalman, the Alter Rebbe, points it out in his work, Likut Torah. Because if you go back to the end of last week's Torah portion, where it says in chapter 12, verse number 34, there it says, Vayisa ha'am es betzeko tam yechmatz. The people picked up its dough when it had not yet become leavened. Misharosam, the leftovers, tsuros besimlosam, which were bound up in the garments, al shechmam, on their shoulders. And then it says in verse 37, they had the dough on their shoulders, and they traveled from their initial meeting point, which is the city of Ramses. Verse number 37. So they traveled from Ramses to their first point of destination, which would be Sukkos. They traveled there, and then it says in verse 39, by Yofus Abbatsek, they ultimately would bake the dough that they took out of Egypt and they make it into matzahs. So as the Alter Rebbe points out, from the time that they travel from Ramses to Sukkos, certainly the amount of time it takes for a dough to rise would have passed. And how long can we say that once, from the time you pour water onto flour, it will rise within 18 minutes. By 18 minutes it will rise. So the Alter Rebbe says it's incomprehensible to believe that going from Ramses, and then again, in Ramses they had the dough on their shoulders. And then they stopped over at Sukkos. And then they started baking the matzahs, as the verse says, we just pointed out. There is no question that more than 18 minutes had passed. So therefore, the notion that most people have that the reason we eat matzahs is because the Jews had to bake the matzah before it had time to rise, that's not true. There was a lot of time for it to rise. But as the Alter Rebbe explains in the Likutei Torah, according to Chassidut, that the reason is that there was such a revelation of God. It says, Nigla Aleihem, we say in the Haggadah, Nigla Aleihem, Melech Malchim Malchim HaKadosh Baruch Hu Golem, the God, the King of Kings, revealed himself at the stroke of midnight. And that revelation and the impact, the effects of the revelation continued for a period of time, that if there is a revelation of God, everything is humbled in its presence, including the dough. So therefore, even the dough could not rise because of that revelation. And in fact, as the Alter Rebbe writes, that on Pesach night, when we eat the matzah, we're trying to reenact that experience and experience the type of matzah that the Jews ate going out of Egypt. That matzah they ate was a matzah impacted by God's revelation. And therefore, matzah is called Michla de Menus, is called the bread of belief, because it's the bread where God revealed himself. And when a person eats matzah on Pesach night with a proper kavanah, with a proper intention, one has an opportunity to tap into that level of gilui, of revelation, that took place at the Exodus from Egypt. The verse tells us when the Jewish people left Egypt, it says they left and they were chamushim. On verse number 18, Vayasev Elokim Esom Derech Mamidbar de Yamsuf, and God took the people around towards the way of the wilderness to the Sea of Reeds. V'chamushim alu b'nei Yisrael me'aretz Mitzrayim, and the Jewish people left chamushim. So Rashi tells us in verse 18, he brings two interpretations of what v'chamushim means. One interpretation is that the Jews left armed. They knew they were going to have to fight battles, and they will fight a battle. At the end of this week's third portion of battle against Amalek, they will be fighting battles, and therefore they left armed. Then Rashi brings another interpretation, and Rashi says, Dovr Acher. This would be on page 146. Again, we have the Sappers in Chumash. Rashi says, Echem nechamisha yotzu v'yarboch halakim mesu b'shvelishim yafela, that only one-fifth of the Jews actually left Egypt. It's the second interpretation of Rashi, and the Rebbe points out many times when Rashi brings two interpretations, the first one is the primary one, but nevertheless, he does bring the secondary one from the Mechilta, from the Medrash Mechilta, that only 20%, chamush means 20%, of the Jews left. The other 80% did not want to leave. And therefore, if they did not want to leave, God was going to kill them, because then they had no purpose in remaining in Egypt. Now, we've mentioned in the past many times that in terms of Medrash, one of the difficulties in trying to relate to a Medrash is the Medrash has a language of its own. And many times Medrash can be taken literally. Other times Medrash conveys a message about things that happened on some spiritual level. When the Chumash tells this week's Torah portion that there was a splitting of the Red Sea, there was a splitting of the Red Sea. That actually happened. This week's Torah portion talks about also the miracle of the man falling. 1 month after the Jews leave Egypt, they run out of food, their matzah, supply of matzah remained for 1 month, and then they need food. And therefore, in the middle of this week's Torah portion, middle towards the end, we have the miracle of the man falling upon the camp of the Jews. Those things that the Torah tells us, those miracles that are in the Chumash, we take literally. That's the Kabbalah, that's the tradition we have from Moshe Rabbeinu. When it comes from to Medrash, as I just said, sometimes we take the Midrashim literally, sometimes not, and it's really hard for us to know which ones literally happened and which ones spiritually happened. Are we to take this literally that only 20% left? Let's understand that the Jews left, the verse said in last week's third portion, 600,000 Jews left who were the age between 20 and 60 men, and those are the ones serving the army. We have to assume a similar amount of females, and then we have children. So we can assume, conservatively speaking, that probably around 3-4 million Jews left Egypt. To say that's only 20% of the Jewish people that left, when the Jews entered 210 years before and with 70 people, everything is possible. We talk about miracles, miracles, and miracles. But it's possible that this Medrash has some other spiritual meaning, possibility. Again, I'm not sure which way to go on this. I've not seen anyone talk about it. But what is important to note is that the Arizal, the foremost of the Kabbalists of the 16th century, based on a pasuk in Samuel, which says, Ki lo yidach mimena nidach, he says this verse tells us that there will be no one pushed away when Mashiach will be coming. And he distinguishes between the Exodus from Egypt and our Exodus when Mashiach will come, bringing us back to Israel. That indeed, when the Jews left Egypt, not all the Jews left, whether it was 20% or more, but we do know that apparently a substantial number of Jews did not leave Egypt. But the Arizal tells us this will not be the case when Mashiach will come, but Mashiach's job will be to bring all the Jews back to Yiddishkeit, to Torah, to awareness of mitzvos, And ultimately, all of us will return to Eretz Yisrael. That's what the Rizal tells us. And therefore, in fact, in the Haggadah, when we tell the evil son who has tried to exclude himself, and he says, "What is the avodah to you, the service unto you?" And we respond to him, and we say, we blunt his teeth, and we tell him, "Eloi Yisham Loyoi Nigal," if he would have been there, he would not have been redeemed with his attitude. So as the Rebbe says in the Haggadah, it means that if he would have been then at that time Jewish, before the giving of Torah, then he would have remained in Egypt. He would have died in Egypt. But with our anticipation of the coming Mashiach, and going out of exile, all Jews will indeed leave exile, be convinced somehow by Moshe, by Mashiach, to want to leave and to come back to the ways of Torah and come back to the land of Eretz Yisrael. One of the Jews, again, they're leaving Egypt, and they're being pursued by the Egyptian taskmasters. After several days, the Egyptians feel they made a mistake, letting the Jews leave. And then, in verse number 8, it was God who hardens the heart of Pharaoh. Because it wasn't logical now to lead the Egyptians to pursue the Jews after being battered with 10 different plagues and the first killing of the firstborn. Why would you do that? But at this point, in verse number 8, in our Chumash, page 152, Pharaoh has lost his freedom of choice. In fact, the Abarbanel says that the reason for this is that God wanted now to perform the miracle of the splitting of the sea to really scare the daylights of the other people living in the Middle East, especially in Israel. And he points out that, in fact, when the Jewish people sent spies into Israel 40 years later, and they visit Rachav, she talks about how the splitting of the sea and the killing of Egyptians scared everyone in Israel. So people, they were terrified of the Jewish people. So that's how the Abarbanel of the 15th, 16th century explains the need for this additional miracle. In other words, he asks the question, why was it important for the Egyptians, why did God cause Egyptians to pursue the Jews? After all, the Jews left Egypt. At this point, let bygones be bygones. The Egyptians were bad enough, they're not coming after the Jews. Well, why was this needed? God doesn't perform miracles if they're unneeded. And he says, no, it was very needed, very necessary. That the world found out about this, and in fact, the Medrash tells us that the one remaining survivor, the Egyptians were killed in the sea, drowned in the sea. The one remaining survivor was Pharaoh, who was spit out of the sea, to be able to go and to be a testimony to what happened, and telling the world that indeed the Jews were God's people. But it says, and here I'd like to get off just a bit of a tangent, something interesting that you should be aware of, approach to halacha, and that is on page 152, or chapter, verse number 8, we're in chapter 14, where it says that God hardened the heart of Pharaoh, and he and his army pursued the Jewish people, and it says, "V'nei Yisrael yotzim b'yad ramah." And the Jews left, going out with pride, with raised hand. Yad ramah literally means a raised hand. And there is a saying that Ashkenaz Jews have that Yotzim Yad Ramah, where Yotzeh, we as Jews, Ashkenaz Jews, are Yotzeh, we fulfill our mitzvahs according to the Ramah. Now, who is the Ramah? Again, this is just a play on words, but you should be familiar with this idea in halacha and in Jewish history. That is, in terms of determining halachic issues, we know it's all based on the Torah, but in Torah itself, based on the oral tradition, which explains the five books of Moses. One of the problems that we have with the oral tradition is that many times, many of the discussions in the Talmud end up very unresolved. Many halachas end up being unresolved. We have an open discussion of many different rabbis through generations, and sometimes it's hard to determine what position we actually follow. So the Talmud itself, we have the Mishnah and the Gemara, which was completed by the middle of the 5th century of the Common Era. And after the completion of the Talmud, we have other rabbis trying to figure this out. Which position do we follow? And we had the Gaonim, those that are rabbis up until the 9th, 10th century of the Common Era, mostly in living in Babylon, in southern Iraq, or middle Iraq. Many of them wrote responsa. We have many responsa written also by the Rishonim. The Rishonim period begins around the 10th century till around the 15th century. But the first one to write, to codify the entire Torah into halacha, into Jewish law, would be Maimonides, who was 12th century. He wrote what was called Yad HaChazaka, but he only brings down his opinion, doesn't bring down other opinions. So therefore, it's hard to determine halacha based solely on the works of Maimonides, although some people do. The Rambam, many of the Sfaradim used to do that. It wasn't until the 16th century that we had two great rabbinic leaders making what is called the code, the Shulchan Aruch, bringing different opinions, but these two rabbis would ultimately give their own personal opinion also. And one of the rabbis was Rav Yosef Cairo, who lived in Israel, in fact lives in Sfas. He was a Sfaradic rabbi, and for the most part, he relied on those Rishonim, on those medieval sages who were Sephardic. Not all the time, but most of the time. In fact, he relied on three pillars. One was Yitzchak Alfasi, the Rif, 10th century, who lived in Morocco. He relied on the Rambam, who was, as I said, 12th century in Spain. And Rabbeinu Asher, who was the Rush, also 13th century, who was a German Jew. He was an Ashkenazi Jew. But two of the three, so he had this formula that whenever two of the three would agree, he followed those two. And since most of the time, and since it was two to three were Sephardic Jews, so it comes out he basically based luck more so on the Sephardic tradition. Not all the time, but most of the time. At the same time, he was writing the code. There was another rabbi in Krakow, Eastern Europe, Moshe Isles, his name was. Unbeknown to Rabbi Yosef Cairo, Moshe Isles was doing the same work. And Moshe Isles did not know what was going on with Rabbi Yosef Cairo. Basically, what happened was that Rabbi Yosef Cairo beat Ramat to the punch, so to say, and he published his work first in the 16th century. And once he did that, the Ramat from Krakow felt that for him to just write a whole work would now be superfluous. So he put his glasses onto the what's called the Shulchan Aruch, Rav Yosef Cairo, where he deviates from Rav Yosef Cairo, where he disagrees with him. Now the Rama was a Ashkenaz Jew, and for the most part the Rishonim that he relied on were more so the Ashkenaz Rishonim, more so than the Sephardic Rishonim. And there are a number of differences of opinion between Rabbi Yosef Cairo and the Rama. And in general, after the Shulchan Aruch was written, then you have what we call the Nosek Halem, the other authorities who would take their halachos and try to update it, try to apply it to new social issues and other issues that arose later in the 17th, 18th, 19th, 20th century. We have the Magen Avraham, we have the Taz, we have the Shach. In one of the sections, one of the aphorisms in Hayom Yom written by the Rebbe, he says, Hasidim always had a tradition that all of those Mechabrim, all of those authors, up until the Taz and the Shach, Magen Avraham, who lived in the 17th century, the ones that are included in the Shulchan Aruch, on the side of the Shulchan Aruch, were all written not just by great geniuses, but by great tzaddikim who had special Ruach HaKodesh, special divine inspiration. And even though, you know, the Rama and the Bais Yosef were two great leaders, who's to say that they were more brilliant than anyone else, but there was a certain siyata d'shmaya, a certain help from heaven that we as Jews believe they had. And therefore Jews followed them. And as I said, Ashkenaz Jews, for the most part, when there's a disagreement between the Rama and the Mechaber, who was Rabbi Beis Yosef, we follow the Ramah, we're Yotz with Ramah, and therefore we have this play on words, as I said in verse number 8, Ubnei Yisrael Yotzim Yad Ramah, the Jewish people going out with the raised hand, but it means Yotzah, we're fulfilling our missions according to the Ramah. The Jews, as we said, are pursued by the Egyptians, and obviously the Jews, when they reach the Red Sea, are very upset to find the Egyptians in hot pursuit of them, and they're going to reach the Red Sea at the night of the seventh night after leaving Egypt, and the Red Sea will be splitting that morning, early in the morning, and therefore we will celebrate the seventh day of Pesach as a holiday because of the splitting of the sea. The Pasuk, chapter 16, verse number 3. Oh, 15, verse number 3, let me see. Looking for the pasuk, for the verse where the Jews complain to Moshe, and they say to Moshe, verse number 11, when they see the Egyptians in hot pursuit of them, is because the lack of cemetery space that you've taken us out of Egypt. So the Jews never lost their sense of humor. You know, today in New York City there's a crisis for burying people. There's not too much space in New York City. People have to go now to New Jersey. So the Jews said the same thing. Did you take us out of Egypt because there was a lack of cemetery space in Egypt? And in their statement, they're going to say, Mi yitem huseinu b'midbar. We would have rather, that's in verse number 12, He told one of the Mitzrayim was in Midbar. We'd rather have died in Egypt than dying in the desert. They're going to say that a bit later also, and there they're a bit more clear, and that is in chapter 16 of verse number 3, on our Chumash, page 184. And this is after the Jews are experienced the splitting of the Red Sea, that miracle. And 1 month after going out of Egypt, they complain they have no food, because as we said before, the matzah provisions will last for 1 month. And they say in verse number 3, Mi yitain v'sen v'yad Hashem be'ez Mitzrayim. We would have rather died in the land of Egypt, b'shifteinu al sir habasar, as we sat by the pot of meat. And there we had meat, and we had bread, and we'd love to die that way, not die in the desert. What's interesting is that this verse itself, verse number 3, where they say we would rather die on the flesh pots of Egypt, eating flesh in Egypt, rather than dying in the desert. When Moshe, you go to the book of Deuteronomy, the book of Devarim, where Moshe is going to rebuke the Jewish people, as Rashi says there, before Moshe Rabbeinu dies, is when he's going to reserve his most severe words of rebuke against the Jews. And if you look there in Rashi, the pasuk first mentions about Midbar. And it talks about the rebellions of the Jews against God. And the first thing they mention is about Midbar, in the desert. So Rashi there comments, and he brings this verse, verse number 3, where the Jews complained, they said to God, to Moshe that is, that we would have rather died in Egypt on the flesh pots of Egypt, eating the meat in Egypt. And that is the first rebuke that God gives to the Jewish people. The first thing that he mentions is this comment of the Jews in verse number 3, chapter 16. And apparently that That statement of the Jews, in a certain way, was, I guess, such a terrible statement that God mentions it first. What's so terrible about that statement? And we once talked about this, and basically what I once explained was that generally, you know, there are people in life overcome with desire, with passion, with the desire for things which are inappropriate, pleasure, things which are inappropriate. But the hope is that a person says, right now, I'm a young man and I have these desires, but hopefully I'll grow out of it, hopefully I'll get older and I'll come to my senses, hopefully I'll get older, I'll be able to settle a bit more and just pursue a spiritual lifestyle. Here the Jews in chapter 13, verse number 3, talk about that their dream of life is to be able to die in the flesh pots of Egypt. That becomes their dream of life, to die that way. And therefore, God really rakes them over the coals for this statement, as I said, as Rashi points out in Devarim, the first thing that God rebukes them about 40 years later is this statement in chapter 16, verse number 3. The Jews will experience the splitting of the sea. And on chapter 14, verse number 21, where it says Moshe is going to extend his hand over the sea, and there is a strong wind that's blowing throughout the night. And ultimately the waters dry up and there's a split in the sea, Vayibako Hamayim. And the waters split. So if you look in Rashi says, again that's verse number 21 in Rashi, Vayibako Hamayim, on page 158 in our Chumash. It doesn't say that the waters of the Red Sea split, it says the water split. And Rashi says, Kol Mayim Shba'olam, all the waters of the world split at the same time. Which is can be really understood in two different ways. One way is, as I told you about the Medrash, that the only Egyptian that was left alive and was witness to what happened was Paro. And he is the one who had credibility in the eyes of the nations of the world, and he would be able to go to the people in the world, especially in the Middle East, and talk about this miracle. Now, if one would have thought that the people in the world would have looked to Paro and put him in an institution. When you talk about the splitting of a sea, a Red Sea, people would put him away. Why do people believe him? Well, one of the reasons people believe them is because, as Rashi tells us from the Medrash, there wasn't only a Red Sea that split. All the seas split at the same time. And therefore, when Paro will go to the nations of the world and talk about this miracle, and people will say, yes, indeed, we believe it happened because it happened in our area also. And Paro said, yes, it happened in your area, but I'm telling you why it happened. It happened because it had to happen for the Jewish people. Jewish people were leaving Egypt, and the proof is that they were all spared, and my armies were all destroyed. So this is a miracle done for the sake of the Jews. And because all the people around the world saw the same miracle, they were able to believe it. On the other hand, there's also another aspect to this. The flip side, there's a flip side to this. The flip side is that whenever God performs a miracle, he always wants to see to it that there's room for a skeptic and a cynic to pour cold water over this issue, to doubt it. Because that's the test of life. God is always testing our belief system. And if it would be too apparent to everybody that God is directing the world and that the Torah of truth is the proper approach to life, then there would be no test in life. And therefore, when God performs a miracle of splitting the sea, that is, saving all the Jews, killing all the enemies of the Jews, in order to sow some seeds of doubt in the minds of people, that people should have a choice, God will see to it that all of the waters throughout the world will also split. And therefore, a skeptic and a cynic will say, you know, I'm not convinced that this has to do with the rectitude of the Jewish people and that they're God's people. After all, if it only has to do with the Jews and the Egyptians, why did it happen in the Rhine River? And why did it happen in the Baltic Sea and other seas? And therefore, God gives you the ability to to question, to be cynical, to be skeptical, and to not be a believer, despite all the evidence, to which is to the opposite. And that is the situation with the splitting of the sea, that even though one would say, how could you not believe that God chose the Jewish people? Well, there are those who doubted it because they're able to point to the fact that God, what happened, this phenomenon, happened all over the world. But the Jews did believe. They had no question in their mind. And the verse tells us, in chapter 14, verse 31, Vayar Yisrael, as Yadak Delah, the Jewish people saw the great hand, Asher Asa Hashem and Mitzrayim, that God inflicted upon the Egyptians, Vayiram, as Hashem, and the people revered Hashem, Vayaminu Bashem Moshe Avdo, and now they have full faith in God and in Moshe. The going out of Egypt and reaching Mount Sinai involved three different steps of revelation, one greater than the other. The first revelation took place at the stroke of midnight when the Jews were at the Seders on the 15th of Nisan. As you read in the Haggadah, it says, Nigla Aleim Melech Malchim Melech Makadosh Baruch Hu Golem. Now God, we said this, the God appeared to the Jews and redeemed them, and this was a godly revelation, and the revelation was so great, as we pointed out some 15-20 minutes ago, that everything that was exposed to that revelation was humbled. Even the dough was humbled to the point that the dough didn't rise. So to say, at that stroke of midnight is when, for the first time, God reveals himself to the Jews and says, in a certain sense, Shalom Aleichem, here I am. And therefore, matzah is called Michla de Hemenusa. It's called the bread of belief. It was through that matzah the Jews had this true sense of God, a true feeling of God, first time in their history. 7 nights later, on the 7th night of Pesach, when God would split the sea, splitting the sea was more than a splitting the sea. But the Jews were able to point out and say, Zeh keli v'yanveyu, right? That's part of the Oz Yashir. They said, this is my God. If we look in chapter 15, verse number 2, Zeh keli v'yanveyu, this is my God, and I will beautify him. And as Rashi says, Bichvodo nigla aleihem, the God appeared in all of his glory, V'hayu marin oso b'yetzba, and they're able to, people are able to point with their fingers that this is God. And as Rashi says, Rasa shivcha layam mashalarel neviim, that even a maidservant at the sea was exposed to more divinity than many of the prophets. And therefore this revelation eclipsed the first revelation that took place going out of Egypt. The first revelation was a little more limited because they were in Egypt, and Egypt was a place of paganism, idolatry, and therefore the impact was a little more limited. And we don't find that statement that when the Jews left Egypt, that a maidservant then was exposed to more divinity than a prophet. But here we do have that statement. This is my, by the way, this is my God, is the name of a book by Hermann Wuk, dealing with Judaism. And we got the statement from this verse. And in fact, in Hasidic tradition, you know, for most people, the important days of Pesach will be the first 2 nights when we have the Seder. But according to a Kabbalistic tradition, Hasidic tradition, in a certain sense, the 7th night of Pesach is more significant, the night of Kriyas Yamsuf, the splitting of the sea, because initially when the Jews left Egypt, the 7th night was accompanied with a greater revelation than the first night. And therefore the 7th night and the 8th day is connected, in fact, to the coming of Mashiach, the ultimate revelation of God with the coming of Mashiach. And this all is because, as the Pasuk tells us, the Jews said, Zechariah, this is my God, and I will beautify him, because they're able to point to God. The third and final step of revelation would take place 6 weeks later at the giving of Torah, where the Anoch Hashem Lakecha, where the God opens up everything, reveals himself in the ultimate possible way, And that will only be duplicated when Mashiach will come. There's nothing else that ever happened in Jewish history that was able to equal that experience of the Sinai experience. So it was steps. First night of Pesach, seventh night of Pesach, giving of Mount Sinai. But even though the Jews at the leaving Egypt were exposed to God and there was a true level of faith in God, but in verse number 31, chapter 14, page 162, is where the verse finally tells us that at this point the revelation was so great that the Jews reached a level of emunah, of faith, which was unprecedented both in God and faith in Moshe Rabbeinu. In fact, many people refer to the Shabbos of Shira as the Shabbos of emunah, the Shabbos of faith, because it deals with this belief, and also, as I pointed out a couple of moments ago, that the Pasuk Torah also deals with the man falling at this week's Torah portion. And the man was the bread of faith also, because you had to put your total betochen in God that it was going to rain man the next day and the day after that. They only had enough provisions for each and every day by itself, and Jews had to put their faith in God and not worry about what would be 2 or 3 days down the road. So the whole Shabbos is called the Shabbos of Emunah, Shabbos of faith. And in fact, I once heard a vart, and a nice idea, that there is a minute, there is a custom that this coming Shabbos we take kasha, we eat kasha. Most of us, anyone will put the kasha in the cholent of Shabbos morning, Shabbos afternoon, and that's a custom to eat kasha. So one of the reasons that people eat kasha is because the kasha itself was similar, the kasha itself was similar to the man. It was ovular like the man, crystal-like like the man. So therefore we have the shape of it, that is, was similar to the man. That's the obvious reason why we eat kasha. Well, one of the reasons, anyway. But I once heard a nice idea, a nice vart, that what is the whole idea of emunah? Emunah is faith in God. We have many questions. We're confused many ways why God does certain things in certain ways, which at times seem to be just not right or painful. We have our questions with God. When a person has a question, you have an intellectual question, and you can't find an answer about dealing with theology, dealing with God, what you do is you just put in motion your emunah, your faith in God, and forget about the kasha. Or instead of what we do is we take the kasha and we swallow it. We just forget it, we swallow it, we enjoy it. Instead of being upset about the kasha, we just swallow it and we just put our total faith in God. So therefore we take the kasha, which is the question, so to say, and we swallow it and we enjoy it. And despite our confusion and despite all the issues we have, instead of getting upset about it, we're able to enjoy it by eating the kasha. That's just a nice idea. The Jews at the sea itself, Rashi points out, and Mar tells us, the Jews were broke down into different groups as to what to do before the sea actually split. There were 4 different groups of Jews, the Gemara tells us. One group said, let us go back to Egypt. And one group said, let us just throw ourselves into the Yam Suf, into the sea, and commit suicide. And one group said, let's battle the Egyptians. And one group said, let's just pray to God. And God rejects all these different approaches. And God just tells Moshe to tell the Jewish people, Daber al b'nei Yisrael v'Yisrael, speak to the Jews, let them just travel into the sea. Let them just go further. There's no need to fight the Egyptians. You don't have time to fight. You don't even have time to daven. Put your trust in me totally. I'll take care of everything. And at that point, the Gemara tells us in Tractate Horius that there is a difference of opinion. When God says to Moshe, tell the Jews to go into the sea, there's now a difference of opinion, an argument among the tribes as to which tribe should go first. According to one opinion, each one wanted to go first. According to another opinion, each one wanted the other ones to go first. And the first tribe that will actually get up to go into the sea first would be Benjamin. And in fact, it is, somewhere it tells us, in that merit, because they wanted to go into the sea first, the first Jewish king would come from Benjamin. And that is King Saul comes from Benjamin. But once Benjamin makes a run for the sea, a move for the sea, then Judah realizes that they should be going first, because Judah knows that they should be the leaders. Always were, they should be the leaders. The kings will come from Judah. And Judah tells Benjamin, I want you to back off. And Benjamin really doesn't want to back off. And in fact, according to one version of the Gemara, the people of Judah will take rocks, and throw them at Benjamin, telling Benjamin, back away. And Benjamin does back away. And then Yehuda will go, and the leader of Yehuda is Nachshon ben Aminadav. Nachshon, who was the brother-in-law to Aaron, married to Aaron's sister, Elisheva. And he can't swim. At that time in history, most people couldn't swim. And he will go into the sea, despite the fact that he can't swim. And once the water reaches his neck is when the water will split up into, according to the Gemara, Rashi brings down 12 different sections. When we talk about Nachshon in our history is the one who is that Nachshon Aminadav, the person who jumps into the sea. He's the person who will be the first person to jump in, to do what has to be done. That's the tradition we have, and that's legendary. The Jews come out of the sea, and the Jews start complaining. Says chapter 15, verse number 22, the Jews leave the Red Sea, and in verse 23, they travel to Marasa, it's all in the Sinai Desert, Sinai Peninsula that is. They can't drink the water because it's bitter. And in verse 24, the Jews are going to complain about it. And Moshe screams to God, and then they go to Elim. And then on chapter 16, verse number 1, the Jews will travel to the Midbar Sin, the wilderness of Sin. And they will reach that area on the 15th day of the second month, exactly 1 month after leaving Egypt. And here again, in verse number 2, they will complain against Moshe and Aaron because there is no food. And we'll see a bit later, the Jews also complaining, and one gets the impression that the Jews are always complaining. But truth of the matter is, if you look, as the Talmud points out, that during the 40 years in the desert, the Jews will complain 10 times. It seems a lot because, you know, in the Chumash, 10 times. But 10 times out of 40 years ain't too bad. Once in 4 years, make a complaint. Here's, it's bunched up a bit, but 10 times in 40 years. And in fact, even though, you know, there are those who, you can get this this understanding, this belief that the Jews were rebellious. But the truth of the matter is that if you look in the Midrashim and in the Mefarshim, that generation that received the Torah, that went out of Egypt, was in the desert for so many years, is called the Dor Deya. We refer to them as that generation of knowledge. The generation of people who engaged God at Mount Sinai, who saw God at the splitting of the sea, an elevated group of people. And it's true, we do find them complaining 10 times in 40 years. But when a person is a slave for so many years, slaves are complainers. It's very difficult to rid yourself. You know, the Jews left Egypt overnight. But it took the Jews 40 years to get Egypt out of their system. And, you know, we should not be judging them so harshly, because that's the nature of slaves. Slaves, life is very tough for them, and they see a lot of negatives. They've been mistreated and maltreated by their oppressors, by the slave masters. And therefore, if you look at the different Midrashim and the Mefarshim, the consensus is we talk about them being a Dor Deya. They tripped up a bit, there's no question about it, when it comes to the splitting, when it comes to a golden calf. But even there, if you look in the Rashis and you look at the Mefarshim, we talk about how the Mefarshim go out of the way to try to point out how the basic Jewish people were free of guilt. Only splitting, we talk about the golden calf, 3,000 Jews out of 600,000 were involved with that. That's less than a fraction of a percent. So, in terms of our attitude as to how spiritual they were, the consensus is we're talking about a Dardea, a generation of knowledge of people connected to God Almighty. And one of the examples of that is the Mon. Before the Jews get, next week's Torah portion, Jews will get the Torah Mount Sinai. But before they get the Torah, we have the Jews complaining over here about a lack of food, and that's legitimate. And if you look at Rashi, that was legitimate. Didn't have food. Scary thing. And when you live in Egypt first, and you come out now, it's quite scary. And the Jews got the man. And the Talmud tells us the reason the story of the man precedes the giving of Torah is because lo nitna Torah el ochli aman. Torah was given only to people who eat man. What does that mean? The verse concerning man, the verse tells us that kimenas Hashem lekechem eschem. If you look in chapter 16, verse number 4, where God says, I want them to take the man dvayom b'yom and day by day, l'man anasena, I want to test them. Hayelech b'tzorasi emlo, are they really willing to follow my Torah, to go on my Torah, to grow in Torah? So, especially in Chassidus, the Rebbe talks about this a lot. One can ask the question, the obvious question is, well, what do we talk about? Why does the Torah talk about the test of the man? Man is not a test, it's a gift. Why do you call it a test? As we know, according to the Gemara, Masech Leshuma, and Rashi brings down, the man was something that people were able to taste any taste you wanted in the man, almost any taste you wanted in the man. It was wondrous food. You wanted to taste meat, it was meat. You wanted to have milch, it was milchix. Why is it called a test when it's really a gift? So, the test, as the Rebbe points out, and others point out, was one of the basic tests in life is our ability to serve God free of worry. Being a spiritual Jew is not just performing the commandments. There's a lot more than that. There are many people who perform commandments, and observant Jew is very frum, but they are warriors. They're always worried about any eventuality that could come in the future. Those are people who are religious, but they're not spiritual. The litmus test of a spiritual person is a person who's able to push his worries to the side. Now, to worry is to be human. And it's a natural thing for all of us to worry about all different things that could happen. But as the Alter Rebbe writes, especially in Tanya, that we have the ability, when these worrisome thoughts enter our mind, to push them to the side. We can't prevent the thoughts from entering our mind. We are what we call the ability to be the intermediate. The intermediate is someone who can't prevent evil, improper thoughts from entering your mind. But as soon as they enter your mind, you can choose not to entertain them, not to dwell on them. And that is what a spiritual person does. When a person is overcome, there are certain people by nature are warriors. Everyone worries a bit. But some people are persistent warriors. And when a person is able to take these thoughts and just feel them and push them to the side, that's a sign of a spiritual person. That's a struggle, a very big struggle. Man, God gave the Jews man, which tasted great because you had every taste you wanted in it. But the downside to the man was that it was here today and would not last more than one day. After that day, it just melted away, disintegrated. And the Gemara tells us, "Mi sheyeshlo pas besal, mi sheyeshlo pas hayom, v'dog l'machar." A person who has bread today and is worried about the next day, that shows a lack of bitachon, a lack of true faith in God. You know, today in America, all of us are into insurance. We get all different types of insurance policies for our homes, for our cars, for people get for marriages, all different types of insurance policies. We're into insurance. We want to have security. When the Jews were developing as a nation to get the Torah at Mount Sinai, before they got the Torah, they had to be able to accept this idea that God was going to give you day-to-day food, and if you're not going to act correctly, who knows what will happen the next day. But don't worry about that. Deal with life on a day-to-day basis. And that is why the Pasuk tells us, the verse says in verse number 4, in chapter 16, Laman HaNesen, instead of looking at Man and calling Man a present, it's called a test. The Torah portion, after dealing with the Man, by the way, it's interesting that the Chasam Sofer works it out in such a way that even though it says here they arrived at Elam on the 15th of the second month, which is the month of Iyar, he points out, he's able to work it out and shows us how the Man actually began falling on the 18th of Iyar, which is Lag BaOmer. We know Lag BaOmer is not a Torah holiday, but it's a very important holiday. And like some so for the 19th century shows us how it actually started falling on the 18th of Iyar, which is Lag BaOmer. That's when Lag BaOmer became Lag BaOmer, so to say. Ultimately, Lag BaOmer is important because it's when the Talmidim of the great Rabbi Kiva stopped dying. It's also important because that's when Rav Shimon Baichai, the editor of Zohar, died. But the Chacham Sofer points out that the importance of Lag BaOmer began when the Man began falling the first year coming out of Egypt. The Jews are going to travel and to a place called Rephidim. On page chapter 17, verse number 1, they will rest in Rephidim, and there's no water there. And again, the people will argue with God because of lack of water. And here we have where God will tell Moshe to go with Aaron and to take a rock and to hit the rock, and what will come from the rock, as opposed to 40 years later, we have the story of Moshe saying, told by God to speak to a rock. And there Moshe Rabbeinu gets confused because he knew 40 years before and he would hit the rock over here. That's part of the confusion. But that's a different issue. But the point is that in verse number 7, the Jews make a terrible mistake by staying. It says they tested God and they said, Hayesh Hashem b'kirbeinu mayin. They made a terrible mistake of making a terrible statement. They wondered, is God really with us? We have no water, and maybe God has not been with us. If they're going through all the miracles of these couple of weeks, they still ask that question. And once they said that, that was looked upon as a terrible sin. And therefore, in verse number 8, God will bring upon the Jews Amalek. The battle of Amalek, the first battle against Amalek, which is the eternal battle against Amalek. But this all came about because the Jews questioned whether God really was with them. And we have the battle where Moshe will send Yeshua to wage the battle, to fight the battle. And the Torah tells us in verse number 12 that Moshe Rabbeinu, in the midst of the battle, Moshe is sitting on a rock. And he's being held up, his hands are held up by Aaron and Hur. Hur is his nephew, who is the son of Miriam. And we're going to see him a bit later, meet him a bit later in a tragic way when he's going to be killed when the Jews make a golden calf. But that's a story by itself. But Yeshua wins the battle against Amalek, and God will say in verse number 16, chapter 17, or it's verse number 14, where God says, I will destroy the memory of Amalek. And God says in verse number 16, Kiyad al Keskab, there is a hand on the throne of God. Hashem attends a war against Amalek from generation to generation. The eternal battle against Amalek. And as the verse says later, Rashis Gam Amalek. Amalek is the first of the nations and the worst of the nations, and therefore they have to be totally destroyed. And Chassidus talks about this, and they say, what does Amalek represent? Why is Amalek so terrible that it got to be totally destroyed? And Chassidus tells us that Amalek represents frigidity, spiritual frigidity. The verse, this is repeated, this section, this segment is repeated later in Devarim, Deuteronomy. And there it talks about Asher Karcha B'derach, that they met Amalek on the way going out of Egypt. So Chassidus points out that the word Karcha means not just to meet, but the word Krirut means frigidity. The Jews had left Egypt, and they were riding on a spiritual high. After all, they left Egypt, the splitting of the sea, they saw God, and no nation in the world would try to start up with the Jews. That's suicidal. Amalek was that skeptical nation, skeptics and cynics and heretics, who are going to point out to the world that the Jews are no different than anyone else. We don't care what they went through. It was all accidents. They had good luck. We're going to give them some bad luck. We're going to cool them off. And they did. They cooled off Klal Yisrael to a certain extent. Frigidity. And therefore, God says to Klal Yisrael that your worst enemy, personal enemy, forget about the external Amalek. We don't know what Amalek is anymore. But the internal Amalek is that the part within you, the frigid part within you, that tells you that, you know, you want to do mitzvahs, you can do mitzvahs, and you can daven, you can put on tefillin and observe. But why do it with emotion? Why do it with excitement? Why do it with that flame, that fiery flame? You know, it's part of, you know, you're a human being. As human beings, your job in life is to enjoy life and to work hard and to make a living, provide for your family. And sure, Judaism is an important part of life, but don't get so excited about it. Don't get so wrapped up in it. Because you get too wrapped up in that, you won't be able to make a proper living and do things correctly. So there's nothing wrong with being observant, but if you get too excited, then you can't have excitement in the more important things in life. That's what Chassidus explains this. Today was Yud Shvat, the Yahrzeit of the sixth Lubavitch Rebbe, known as Ryatz. And before he died, the last years of his life, he was disabled, unable to really articulate words correctly because he was paralyzed, partially paralyzed. And he would write discourses in anticipation of events coming up. And he wrote a discourse to be studied on the 10th of Shvat, which was also the Yahrzeit of his grandmother, which would become his Yahrzeit, because he died in 1950 on Yud Shvat. So this discourse was written for Yud Shvat of 1950, just that he died. But we had the discourse. And in the discourse, he talks about the Mishkan, the tabernacle, and he talks about the Atzei Shittim. Tabernacle is made of acacia wood. And he says the word Shittim, which is the word of straying away. He says there's the approach, which is a rational approach, intellectual approach, which is considered to be a proper approach in life. Then there's the approach of emotion, where people get wrapped up in desire and emotion and impulse, which takes you away from the straight approach in life. That's called the Shittim. And he says there is that approach of the Shittim, where we get involved in desires and pleasure, the physical pleasures of life. And when a person gets involved in physical pleasure, when a person has this pursuit of it, hot pursuit of it, then automatically your approach to divinity is going to be very tepid and very frigid. In order to bring the holiness into the Mishkan, which had Atzei Shittim, our job is to take all of that passion and that heat that we have for the physical pleasures of life and transform it to the heat of Kedusha, to pursuing the mitzvos, whether it's lighting Shabbos candles, whether it's putting on tefillin, whether it's giving tzedakah, not just to do it mechanically, but to do it with a passion, with a desire, with what we call a brand of true fire. And that is really the essence of that segment of the Maamar, which is, in fact, this year we studied the third segment of the Maamar, talking about the importance of transforming the passion that we have for the physical pleasures of life. We have the ability to transform that. We need physical things in life. There's nothing wrong with enjoying life. Nothing wrong with having a nice Suda and enjoying Shabbos Suda and throughout the week also. But our true passion got to be in the passion of not just doing mitzvahs, but helping people because you love to help people, because you're really excited about helping people. It's not enough to help you. We've got to have a passion for it. And that's what Amalek tried to do. Amalek tried to take away the passion in Klal Yisrael. The Amalek represents, there's the external Amalek, the nation of Amalek. And when Mashiach will come, we'll find out who they are. They'll be destroyed. But there's the internal Amalek. That's for us more relevant to us right now. And that internal Amalek is the Amalek within us, that force within us that tries to get us to do mitzvahs, but do it dispassionately without that true drive and fire. So as I said, it's a great Shabbos, the Shabbos of faith. eat your kasha, swallow the kashas, enjoy the kashas, and mitzvah to the ultimate revelation, the coming Mashiach speedily in our time.